Welcome to Jazz Fest 35, chronicles of the 35-year history of the Syracuse Jazz Fest. I'm Joe Lee, along with Jazz Fest founding director Frank Malfitano, and today we focus on the downtown years, 1991 through 95. These years could be considered early adolescence for Jazz Fest. Were there growing pains, growth spurts, rebellion? Let's ask my good friend Frank Malfitano. Frank, what was the impetus for moving the festival to Clinton and Hanover Squares?
I was working in Manhattan in the jazz industry. I worked at the Blue Note Jazz Club, and I worked for Jazz Booking Agency, the Brad Simon Organization, representing people like Max Roach and Cecil Taylor and Sun Ra. And I was producing all the Long Branch festivals when I was in Washington, D.C. As associate publisher of Jazz Times magazine for a couple of years, and when I was working in New York. When I took the job as executive director of the Landmark Theater, I realized that I wanted to have the festival downtown for a couple of reasons. I thought if it's downtown and if it's free, it's going to increase our attendance. It's probably going to increase our chances for sponsorship. And it did all of that. So I approached the then mayor of the city of Syracuse, Tom Young. And I asked Mayor Young if he would get behind this. And he did, in a big way. He got his economic and community development people knocking on doors for money. He found us our title sponsor, Merchants Bank, which later became On Bank, which later became M&T Bank. Mm-hmm. And they've been with us for 25 years. National Grid came on board, our good friend Melanie Littlejohn. Our sponsorship went from about $2,000 a year up to about $60,000.
Okay.
And our attendance, we had 2 days in 1991. One day in Armory Square. Actually, yeah, the first day was in Armory Square, and the second day was in Clinton Square. So immediately the festival expanded. We had an opportunity to bring in more acts. We had more money. We had bigger attendance. It became a huge event in its first year downtown. And that's really, I think, the beginning of the modern era for Jazz Fest.
And did you feel more pressure once that budget shot up like that? And did you feel more pressure to put on an outstanding festival?
We always wanted to put on an outstanding festival. I always wanted to raise the bar and jump over it and keep raising the bar, you know. You know, you become a victim of your own success. I mean, it's like Tiger Woods. You can't always go out and top yourself, but that's the goal. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel any more pressure being downtown, but I knew that we had, again, to come out of the block strong. So that first year downtown, we had some pretty amazing people. We had Dave Brubeck, and it was on Father's Day. So the middle of June kind of became our permanent weekend for a while when Clinton Square was our home for 10 years.
Yeah.
And that was all kind of launched with Dave Brubeck, and Dan Brubeck was playing drums with him, and Les McCann came in, and the Yellow Jackets, and Frank Morgan and George Cables. And then the following year was Grover Washington Jr., Ahmad Jamal, the Brecker Brothers, Freddie Hubbard. I mean, those were amazing years. I mean, those first couple of years downtown really got us out of the blocks.
And the change from Long Branch to downtown, what were the festival goers' attitudes toward change?
Well, you know, Joe, when you move downtown, you're on pavement. So you're not on a lawn setting anymore. So the whole vibe of the event kind of changes. But it didn't get angry. It was manageable. It was fine. You know, wherever we went, whether it was Long Branch or Clinton Square or later OCC, we always had to retrofit into the site that was there. Those sites weren't built for performance. You know, Clinton Square, nothing had taken place in Clinton Square before we got there except the annual Christmas tree lighting, and they weren't even doing that on Black Friday.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people who may be new to the area or too young to remember those years haven't experienced that downtown festival. Won't you paint a picture for us?
Well, in the first year, like I said, we were in Armory Square one day, and the next day we were in Clinton Square. After that, they built a huge apartment complex on Walton Street in the parking lot where we were at Jazz Fest 91. And so that space no longer became available. So we moved over to Clinton Square for both days, and then we started doing noontime concerts at Hanover Square and after-work concerts, happy-hour concerts at Hanover Square. So we had room for a lot of acts, and I think at that point we had a 3-day festival. So we were in the square on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, And we were over in Hanover Square Monday through Friday. So right away, we made a quantum leap to a seven-day festival.
And there was a period, one of those years, or maybe two, where a lot of different acts played in different clubs and restaurants. You remember that?
Oh, I remember it vividly.
What was the... I remember there was like Daniel Webster's, I think Sakura was around back then. There was a blues that blues spot down in Clinton Square. Did you do something in there?
We did. We Georgia's. We used to do our kickoff party over at Stereo's Landmark in the Gridley Building, right across the street. We did things at Stylene's, which I think was the Zodiac when we started out.
Stylene's is what I was thinking of.
Stylene's.
Yeah.
We did things at Possibilities. Yeah. We were all over. We had a lot of non-traditional storefronts, restaurants, bars that had music policies. We even did something at Carousel Mall, now Destiny Mall. We did something at a car dealership. We were all over town so that people who like the clubbing experience could really go check out these acts. And then again, these acts did this as a favor to us because they played the main stage and they said, yeah, we'll do the club thing to help you build the festival. So we did that for a couple of years.
And was that did that present some logistical nightmares?
Oh, my God, it was a nightmare. I mean, it was a ton of work, but we enjoyed it. You know what I mean? But the problem was the sponsors wanted to see big crowds in the square. And what was happening is a lot of people preferred the club intimate, you know, I like this little thing for me kind of thing. And I don't really care about a mass audience, but the sponsors cared about a mass audience. And also, you know, that wasn't really the deal breaker. The deal breaker was that some of the bars and restaurants were great to the artists and some didn't even provide them with potato chips.
Yeah.
And no sound system, no sound crew. So there were some operational issues.
Yeah, I had a good time. It was my early years here. I remember seeing Roy Hargrove at a little spot down on Erie Boulevard.
Sure.
Hank Crawford, I think, at and Jimmy McGriff over at Daniel Webster's. That was quite a show.
Hank fell off the stage, man.
Hank
was a little toasted that day.
I think he had something to sip on all day long.
Yeah. Well, again, I think, you know, look, you're talking about one of the great saxophonists of all time, probably the greatest alto saxophonist, played all those hits with Ray Charles, just a genius. And he and Griff in the Jimmy Smith tradition, one of the great B3 players of all time and a dear friend. I had presented him with Jazzmobile in the 70s. It was just great to have those guys.
To Griff's credit, When Hank fell, I mean, Griff didn't skip a beat. He just kept going.
He kept going. I was standing next to, of all things, there was a group called Bob's Diner in town that year. Great band. And the guitar player was dating an actress by the name of Sonia Braga. I was standing with Sonia Braga, and she said, oh, look, the sax player fell off the stage.
My first Jazz Fest was 1993. I got here in fall of 92, so that following year was my first Jazz Fest. We're talking Spyro Gyra, Dr. John, Tuck and Patty, Roy Hargrove, New York Voices, and Nancy Kelly. And I was pretty excited that WAER was involved, and I was exuberant. And we bumped heads. You remember that?
Was that the year? That might have been. Yeah, I remember when you got to town, we had a spirited discussion about you thought I should bring in Betty Carter. And I said, you know, what do you know? I don't want to hear from you. I don't want any suggestions. But you know what? I was a huge Betty Carter fan. And I went to see her every chance I could at Fat Tuesday, which was like a fallout shelter in New York City in the Village. I was a huge fan. I you know, at that point, I was still feeling my way, and I probably wasn't as nice as I should have been because you certainly had a lot of expertise. And I think I opened up after that. I think that was, you were the guy that broke through, but I think you got hit with the doorknob a little bit.
I was young and exuberant and stupid.
No. It was a great suggestion, and we should have had her. And now, you know, we never had her, and now she's gone. And that's, you know, that's something I regret. But I do remember that year because Dr. John came in with the big band, and he had Alvin Red Tyler on, Ronnie Cuber on saxes. Oh, my God, man. I mean, that was an amazing year. Yeah, that was cool.
So the following year, 94, I think from a programming perspective, is one of the standout years in the entire history of Jazz Fest. You're talking Sonny Rollins, you're talking Les McCann, Herbie Mann, Hank Crawford and Jimmy McGriff, Charles Erlin, Donald Harrison, special effects, and so many more. That caliber of lineup suggested, or seems to me to suggest, big budget. Was that the case? What do you remember of that year? And do you agree that was one of the sort of marquee years in the history of Jazz Fest.
Oh, yeah, there's absolutely no question that 94 was a seminal year for us. I mean, anytime you get Sonny Rollins on your stage, you know, I don't see this on the lineup, but I remember it very well because he was wearing a New York Giants baseball cap backstage and as the JBs. And he looked at me backstage and he says, "Hey, man," he says, "why are you putting me on after this party band?" And I said, "Trust me, nobody's going anywhere." And he absolutely levitated the festival. Yeah, we also have Little Jimmy Scott that year. And again, that was a year where artists were playing all over town. So like Jimmy Scott did three gigs. Mm-hmm. So you got to see Jimmy Scott three times, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, those were amazing years, amazing memories. But you're right. That was a year we took things to the next level.
And holding a major outdoor festival in the middle of a city has to involve some politics. Did it?
You know, it did. And it's unfortunate. That's always kind of been the bane of my existence. I'll just be very forthright about this and tell you that our media partners like WER have been sensational. Our fans have been outstanding in good weather and bad, through monsoons, through rain, through 40-degree dips in temperature. I remember when Grover came out, it was 90 the day before. By the time he hit the stage, it was 50. But our fans were great. Our artists loved playing the festival, gave us the best they had, and gave us breaks on prices and fees. Everybody was fantastic. The media was great to us. Unfortunately, the politics were... Tom Young was out of office shortly after we brought the festival downtown, and we had to deal with the next administration. And those were the Bernardi Nicoletti years, and that was not a pleasant time. But fortunately, we had a great guy by the name of Pat Hogan, who worked for the Parks Department, who ran interference with us with police and fire and everybody else. And, you know, everybody loved it downtown, and it was great. And it was a perfect era for its time. It was the perfect venue.
This is Jazz Fest 35, Chronicles of the 35-year history of the Syracuse Jazz Fest. I'm Joe Lee with founding director Frank Malfitano. And next time on Jazz Fest 35, years 1996 to 2000, the downtown location begins to see some truly colossal acts like Ray Charles.
The first time I saw Ray live, I mean, Ray was the guy that did it for me. When I was in high school in the 50s and early 60s, Ray Charles blew me away. I mean, that was it. I didn't get to see Ray Charles live until the early 70s in Detroit. When I saw him, that was life-changing, man. But being able to present him, wow.
Jazz Fest 35 is produced by Kevin Kloss with music direction from Eric Cohen. Previous episodes of this limited podcast are available on demand at waer.org.